Session number 13305, reel number 1.
Mr. Redway, reel 1. Could you tell me, first of all, what you were doing at the outbreak of war, please?
Yes, I'd graduated from Cambridge in June of 1939, and I was embarking on a course of research into Middle High German with the view to becoming a don, following in my father's footsteps, not as a historian, but as a linguist. And my valuable studies were interrupted by a summons to join the Suffolk Regiment on the 15th of November of 1939, which I duly did, and that started my career as a private soldier in the Suffolk Regiment.
What had been your reaction to the news that we were at war with Germany?
Well, one of great sorrow, because I'd been to Germany every year since 1934 to help with my competence in the German language, and I had many friends there, and although it seemed inevitable in the later stages of that summer that we would be at war, you never quite believed it until it actually happened, and so it was a very considerable shock.
What had been your own personal attitude towards the German regime?
Well, the German regime was fairly remote from a student. What one had enjoyed was the company of young Germans rowing down the Main River in a German four, playing golf at the course in Kiel, which was started by British naval officers before the First War, and enjoying visits to the Bavarian Alps, where we had a ski hut to which we sent parties of skiers to meet their German equivalents about twice a year from about 1934 onwards. So we had many links there and many friends, and inevitably it was a considerable shock to find ourselves at war.
Had you, before the war, on your visits to Germany, considered the country as a threat to Britain?
Yes. I think one couldn't escape from the fact that from about 1935 onwards, Germany was clearly rearming very fast. And I saw the reverse side of the Nazi movement from living in a Jewish or Jewish-German family in Frankfurt for 3 months in 1936 and revisiting it in 38 and 39, during which time the regime had clearly become much more oppressive.
Can we pick up your own army career from Bury St. Edmunds, please?
Yes, it was fairly simple. I think in early January of 1940, I was summoned to the War Office to be interviewed on the basis of my languages, French and German, to do a new and interesting sounding intelligence job of joining a special mission which would tell the Bomber Command Chief in northern France where the Germans ended in the event of war breaking out, and where the Allies began, and keeping the Commander-in-Chief of the Land Forces informed of what the situation was at the front, in order that he could allocate his reserves in a sensible way. The basis of this unit being formed was that there were doubts about whether the fixed communications of the First War would be repeated in the Second. And because people thought that probably the lines coming back from the front would not work as they had in the First War, you needed something else that was mobile and relied on its own signals for communicating with the people who had to decide on where to drop the bombs and where to allocate the reserves.
What was the name of this unit you were invited to join?
The name of it was Number 3 Military and Air Mission. Air, because the commander-in-chief of the bombers, Air Marshal Barrett, was the prime recipient designate of this information, and military because the unit itself was very largely military, with a small RAF element in it. So it was Number 3 Military and Air Mission, jointly commanded by a Wing Commander Fairweather, who was a very bright South African in the RAF, and a brilliant soldier, General Hopkinson, or Colonel Hopkinson as he was then, who later became General Hopkinson, commanding the 1st Airborne Brigade, who was killed at Taranto in 1943.
The role of the unit was fully explained to you at the time?
Yes, I was to be one of 6 intelligence officers on motorbikes, competent in message writing and Morse code, and our business was to go to forward formations and find out what was happening and get the information back as soon as possible to mission headquarters, who would then relay it to Bomber Command and to the Commander-in-Chief.
Why were you so suitable to do this kind of job?
Partly because the source of the information we would get might well be Francophone. Second, because it was always useful to have someone who was Germanophone in case there were prisoners or people who didn't speak anything but German. And also because we were all pretty young, recent graduates from the universities, who were thought to be elastic enough to get on motorcycles and find our way by map reading and so forth, and generally be competent to interview people in the field without being regarded with undue suspicion.
What kind of training did you then receive?
We did a great deal of motorcycle training, a great deal of map reading, a great deal of message writing, and a good deal of wireless operating, learning the Morse code and how to transmit in clear.
Who was in charge of your work?
Hopkinson, the commander of the military branch of this Number 3 Military and Air Mission, was our immediate boss. He was in liaison with the Air Force element, and in charge of the intelligence section, of which I was one of the 6 members, was a Captain Collings, who was an ex-regular and had been brought in because he had a knowledge of the language and also had lived in Belgium for some time.
Where was your training done?
Our training was based on Valenciennes in the French sector of France. British were based on places like Arras, Lille, Cambrai, and the French sector was denied to most people, but we were put there because we were handy for going into Belgium up the road to Mons should the balloon go up, which it did eventually on the 10th of May of 1940.
Did you have any special insignia? Was it a regiment or what?
It was a composite unit. We had a white P on a black background standing for Phantom, which was the radio code name which appeared on all our messages. But we came from different regiments. We had 12th Lancers in charge of the armoured car section. We had Queen Victoria Rifles running a motorcycle platoon, mostly of keen motorcyclists from the City of London, under a Lieutenant Morgan, who spent the whole war with Phantom. and then various people brought in from various other regiments, like Captain Collings, who was an Inniskilling Dragoon Guard, Captain Newton Dunn, who was the adjutant, who was an RAC man. So yes, we were composite, and our common insignia was the white P on the black background, which stayed with us until we were dissolved when the war ended.
What happened to you between your joining number 3 MAM and the German attack of the 10th of May?
We trained really very vigorously. The French had a comfortable system of wireless silence, meaning that they didn't practice their radio for fear that the Germans would pinpoint where they were broadcasting from. I think probably the same rule applied to us, but Colonel Hopkinson was not one for the rules if they obviously didn't make sense, and we practiced flat out with the radio as well as the dispatch writing and map reading and message writing. The result of this was that when the balloon did go up on the 10th of May, phantom radio worked from the start, whereas most of the French radio didn't work at all.
What were the main problems that you personally had to face in those few months up to the 10th of May?
Well, it was great fun. There we were all young people. I was 21. And to have this privileged position and have most of northern France at your disposal as a training ground, and to have the best of food in a French hotel and the good company of this very likable bunch of people who turned up there was pure delight. And the great question mark, of course, was whether the balloon would go up or whether the Maginot Line would deter the Germans, and if it did go up, when.
Did the German attack take you by surprise?
No, I don't think so, because the colonel had rehearsed what would happen if the balloon did go up, as he was convinced it would. And I can remember getting information at about 4 o'clock in the morning on the 10th that the German attack had begun, and we were all on the road by about 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock that morning, packed up and gone.
What happened to you then?
We rode up the road to Mons, or towards Mons, and then we split into two parties. One was the forward unit under Colonel Hopkinson, which went to discover what was happening on the battlefront, to discover, for example, as it did earlier, that the bridge at Maastricht had not been blown, but the Germans were pouring over it. That was the main body of the military side. The RAF side went to establish itself near Belgian GHQ, or GQG as it was called, at a fort called Braindonk, not so very far from Brussels. And there they set up the wireless station, which took messages from the advanced element and relayed them to Bomber Command and GHQ. And I went with that headquarter party. I was detailed to do that and work largely as a cipher officer, encoding and decoding messages, and occasionally getting out on my motorbike on some bit of reconnaissance.
What was the attitude of the Belgian civilians to the entry of the British Army?
Most enthusiastic. They reckoned that we'd stood by them in the First War, and here we were setting off blithely to hurl the Germans back out of Belgium. And the main threat from them was boxes of chocolates hurled at our column, one of which struck me severely on the head as I was riding my motorbike. But the goodwill was tremendous, and although it turned into disappointment as the war went wrong, The reception we got was heartwarming.
This was in Brussels itself, was it?
No, it was on the road between Valenciennes up to Braindonk, where we formed our headquarters.
Was there much jumpiness about a fifth column?
Yes, there was a great deal of jumpiness. I think the Germans had a reputation for being enterprising about parachuting down ostensible nuns who turned out to be stormtroopers and various other bits of skullduggery. And rumour flies very fast in a situation like that, and there was very considerable anxiety about Fifth Column activities mounted by the Germans.
Did you come across any hard evidence of such?
None.
Any incidents that happened to you in those days that you can recount?
The one I remember best was going into Antwerp on my motorbike behind Admiral Keyes. Admiral Keyes, who had played such an important part in the Zeebrugge blockade in the First War, was Winston Churchill's private representative in the Battle of Belgium, and he had gone out with two purposes. One, to keep Churchill informed about how things were going, and he used our communications for this purpose. And second, to have a look at the preparations by the Navy to blow up the facilities in Antwerp. And I had a most enjoyable ride down behind his car see about, or let him see about, the demolition work by the Navy. And it's something I shall never forget, because on a lovely summer day, this I suppose would be about May the 22nd, might have been, of 1940, we rode into Antwerp, which was a totally dead city. All the Belgians had gone, and the Germans hadn't yet arrived. And so you had this extraordinary sensation of a completely empty city. And the only people who seemed to be at all active were our naval people down on the docks, who made satisfactory bangs as they blew up the cranes and other facilities.
Did you have any narrow escapes from any enemy warfare?
Yes, in this sense that when the Germans were quite clearly in the ascendant, the Belgians took to the roads, which was a very sad thing in a way, because they decided they wouldn't stay in Belgium under German domination, which seemed likely. And so they packed their goods into farm wagons and lorries and set off down the already congested roads, where they were fair game for German Stukas and other aircraft, which strafed them up and down. Well, it was part of my business to go down these roads, and so you did find yourself able to move, which is more than most people did because of the motorbike, but subject to air strafing. And in particular, I remember one, I think just outside Ostend, a German plane came over very low and dropped a bomb in a field about, I suppose, 100 yards away from where I was. Made a great bang, but the field being soft, it didn't do any damage, but I did come away with a bit of shrapnel as a souvenir.
Where did the shrapnel go?
Shrapnel, I'm not sure. It didn't hit me, but I think I probably found it by the side of the road, and we kept it for some time when we got home to Cambridge. It was in my pocket when I was on the ship on the way home, which was sunk, and so I did arrive with a rather rusty piece of shrapnel in my pocket.
What's your estimate of the usefulness of the work which No. 3 Military and Air Mission did in Belgium then?
Well, it certainly worked. It certainly provided Bomber Command and the Commander-in-Chief and a number of French units, and the Belgians for that matter, with useful information quickly relayed from the front so that a firm estimate could be made of what was actually happening in the battle. And this was judged to be so valuable that when those of us who weren't killed got back to Britain, the work of the number 3 military and air mission was clearly highly esteemed by the War Office, which ordered that the establishment of this unit should be increased about 5 or 6 fold, and that we should get on with it as quick as possible with a view to having a unit which would produce right information in case the Germans invaded England, which it was then considered they probably would. And so we reformed as quickly as possible, and we wouldn't have had that amount of backing if we hadn't been considered to be very useful in the Battle of France and Belgium.
How chaotic were things for you, if at all, during those few weeks in Belgium? Were things controlled for you, or was it chaos?
Well, the situation was clearly chaotic and fast-moving, where the Germans were penetrating and overcoming resistance. We kept thinking that the Allies would stand on a succession of rivers, the Dyle and the Maas and so on, but the Germans swept on, and so the news was extremely uncomfortable. We personally were perfectly comfortable. We had our regular army rations supplemented with things we found locally, and we slept comfortably in vacated country houses and farms. So physically we were very comfortable until the day came on the 27th of May, when we were told that the game was up and we should board a couple of little steamers in Ostend. And so we went from quite a comfortable place at Bruges, where we'd been staying in a country house, to Ostend, and went on board ship.
Do you remember the name of the ship?
Yes, I do. There were two ships. One was called the Marquis, and the other was called the Aboukir. And the Marquis had most of the intelligence section on it, and the Aboukir had most of the RAF headquarters section on it, which included myself because I'd been seconded to it. And the Marquis slipped out first at dusk, heading for Britain, and the Aboukir a little later. And the Marquis was attacked by an E-boat and was not sunk, although torpedoes were launched at it. The Aboukir was not so lucky and was sunk in the middle of the night, a few miles off Dunkirk.
What are your personal memories of the sinking of the Aboukir?
My personal memory was how very flimsy ships are. We'd all got on board this ship, and I think there were 300 or 400 British evacuees of one sort or another, and I suppose we had about 12 officers, 11 RAF and myself, and then various people like pilots who were shot down, and I suppose we had about 30 men from the headquarters section and one or two hangers-on. And the ship went down in, I would say, within a minute of being struck. It was a very small ship. And from then on, it was sauve qui peut.
Where were you in the ship?
I'd arrived late, and the early arrivals had found cabins, or reasonably comfortable places. but I was up on the top deck by the funnel with a fellow cipher officer called Bill Humphreys, who was a scholar of St. Catherine's College, Cambridge, and was the business manager adjutant of that little party of RAF people. And he and I dossed down together by the funnel because it seemed warm. And I can remember when the torpedo struck, we both jumped up. And I think he turned round to make sure that his ciphers were in place and that he'd got hold of them. I saw a boat swinging out and jumped into that on its davits. But of course there was no time to lower it. And as the ship went over, the lifeboat was turned upside down. And I was agreeably surprised after a little while underwater to come up and find that I was still alive. Bill Humphreys was never seen again, nor were most of the other officers.
So if you'd have arrived early, you would have been killed?
I think that's very likely, because I was the only one of the 12-odd officers of our party who survived.
Were you a swimmer?
Yes, I was quite a good swimmer. And I had learnt in the Boy Scouts at school how to build a little raft out of bits and pieces. And so I managed to build a rather rickety sort of raft from bits and pieces floating in the water and get most of my body out of the water, because in cases like this, it's hypothermia, which is a bigger killer than gunpowder.
How long were you in the sea for?
About 5 or 6 hours, I would say. And then a destroyer turned up more or less at dawn. And a rather touching thing, there was a stockbroker, squadron leader called Roger Sanders, who had hung on close to me from the moment of the torpedoing. And he was so elated at the sight of the destroyer approaching that he loosed one hand to wave at it. And this unhinged his balance, and he disappeared and wasn't seen again.
Did anybody else from the Aboukir, was anybody else rescued?
Yes, I think I was the only officer, and I think about 15 or so of the Phantom personnel were rescued, but quite a lot went down.
Which destroyer rescued you?
I think it was called the Greyhound. I think that's right, because I remember that we got on board this and made off towards England, but then we were handed over to another one. I think it was called the Javelin. And I may have got the order wrong, but those were the two ships, I think, which were involved, and one of them put us into Dover, much to everybody's relief.
So this was the 28th of May?
28th of May.
What condition were you in by the time you were rescued?
Well, I wasn't at all too bad. I mean, I can remember being hauled into the boat, and when I got onto the deck of the destroyer, I found I could walk perfectly well, and was given a nice little warm cabin with cocoa, and really felt on top of the world. I didn't then know, of course, the extent of the casualties we'd had.
What happened to you after this?
Being in the army machine...